to the Palestinians because I don't want to put them at risk. But she came up to me and told me about these individuals in the West Bank who heard about Cameron doing hunger strike, and they got really emotional and were grateful. Yeah, and they wanted me to send a message to Cameron specifically and saying that they're so grateful for his solidarity and what he's doing. I had also another Palestinian. They call him the hummus guy. He does his rounds on social media. And he said something about the experience of what Cameron and the political prisoners at the moment are going through mirrors some of what the Palestinians are going through, from the hunger strike to the imprisonment to the censorship, all of these things where they're doing an uphill battle to get their freedom. It's closely mirrors it. It's not exact, but it mirrors it. And it's like they're living the experience of a Palestinian, and they don't have to. This is the option, right? In this country, we don't have to do those things, but they choose to, because how are you supposed to be liberated when there is somewhere across the world a group of human beings that are being killed and being denied the liberation that we can so freely do? But yes, Cameron was arrested last year on the 19th of November, and he was part of the 8 that then increased from the Filton 10 to the Filton 18. And then since then, I think, I don't know if it's been widely reported, I think some people know about it, but Cameron did get bail. He was one of the first Filton, at the time Filton 18, to be granted bail on the basis of looking after my parents, on the basis that the judges felt that there was enough stipulations to stop any chances of reoffending or risk of reoffending. And he was granted that. But within that same space of the judge putting her mallet down and saying, you've got bail, the CPS had their hands up so fast, and they appealed. They appealed the judgment, and we went to the Royal Courts of Justice, which wasn't so just.
So they appealed to the High Court?
Yeah, so they appealed the decision. So it got taken to High Court because that's where the appeals are heard.
Mm.
It was interesting because a judge asked Cameron to come down to the court. So he, at that time, was at Thameside, a prison which he was getting on fairly well with. He wasn't having too much difficulties there. But the judge brought him to the High Court. He wasn't able to hear the first half because, as many people know, if you've had any involvement with prisoners and trials, the prisons never come on time because the vans are incapable of bringing the prisoners on time. So he actually missed half of his bail appeal. And the other half that he heard was the judge basically talking to him like he was guilty. Mm-hmm. So when Cams reflects upon this, it's like they've made the decision of what I am, but actually I'm a remand prisoner. And I always thought the UK justice system was innocent until proven guilty. Mm-hmm. But in this case, as we have seen with the Filton 24 and a lot of the activists that are now in prison, they get treated like they're guilty before their trial. And so all of a sudden they're doing sentences before their actual trial. So it doesn't matter whether they get acquitted or they get found not guilty or they get sentenced. They've already done a sentence. They've done like a prison time already. That at the appeal, his bail was then denied, despite our barrister actually putting in more stipulations to make his bail conditions more stricter. So to appeal to the judge, but it got denied. And that sort of glimmer of hope that he would be out up until his trial was taken away from us. And his trial is now set for June 2026. So that's almost, I think, 18 months since he first got arrested.
Wow.
Which is wild. So he's been in prison for a year and a half. That's an actual sentence.
By the time that his trial is currently scheduled in June next year, he will have, unless somehow he's granted bail between now and then, he will have been imprisoned on remand for 18 months. And that's astonishing when you put it that way.
Yeah. And I think we have to look at the basis of what happened with those. In fact, he got bail and then it got appealed. And then what was interesting was the judge that granted him the bail all of a sudden was taken off from the rest of the trials for the Filton 24. So she was the original judge to basically set up the trials, so to get everything ready and in order before the judge that was actually going to be sitting on the trial was going to take place. But she was taken off. And that happened straight after Kamsa's bail verdict. So that was...
This was in a Crown Court.
Yes, this was in Crown Court. Yeah. This is at the Old Bailey. Mm. And she's a very well-respected judge. So to overturn her decision, it's not something that would be done lightly.
What was her name?
Justice Chima Grubbs.
There's a variety of factors, I think, with all of this. Like when you mention about the inability of the prison service to bring Cameron even on time to his hearing, there's a wider institutional problem here with the British so-called justice system. Britain has a system of decaying Victorian prisons, and you know, successive governments have underinvested in the justice system to the extent that, you know, even what would be called in America public defenders, you know, or legal aid in this country, are no longer as widely available as they used to be for many people. But also, I think what we're definitely seeing with Palestine Action connected prisoners is an establishment stitcher. You know, like, I mean, what you mentioned there about the judges who granted Cameron bail is really fascinating. I hadn't known that. Now, she's been taken, therefore, off all the other cases. I mean, we perhaps don't have time to get into the full thing today, but even with the case that Huda Amouri, the co-founder of Palestine Action, is taking against the government to unban Palestine Action, with that as well, I mean, I wrote a story about how, and as others as well have covered it, about how the judge on that case was taken off the case at the last minute and replaced by a panel of three judges, two of whom are certainly close to the British establishment, we could say, and at least one of whom certainly has links to the pro-Israel lobby. So we're seeing the British state put out all of its power to stop Palestine Action and to punish activists who have taken direct action against an Israeli arms manufacturer, Elbit Systems. It's the largest private Israeli arms manufacturer. It provides 80% of Israel's drone fleet, and it is components built and assembled in this country are then being used to carry out a genocide in the Gaza Strip. So, you know, this is what has really motivated the campaigners. Shamina, put this in a little bit more context. You know, he's been on remand for more than a year now, and as you said, by the time of his trial in June, he will have been on remand for a year and a half. What is he actually charged with?
So currently the charges stand as criminal damage and violent disorder and aggravated burglary. Those are the three charges.
You can see how this is a political, it's absolutely a political case. He's a political prisoner because these are things that normally, as was mentioned by Francesca, that someone would normally be on remand for such an allegation. Someone would not normally be on remand this long and would have been granted bail. And as you said, he was actually granted bail, but it was then appealed. So how has he been treated, Shamina? How has he actually been treated inside prison? How is it going for him inside right now?
After the appeal hearing for his bail, he got moved to Pentonville. And so he has been in Pentonville since then. His initial move to Pentonville, the sort of the buffer period whilst he got there was really difficult. He came over whilst he was fasting. And one of the incidents that took place was they weren't going to give him dinner because he'd bypassed the time of dinner. Like, dinner was given an hour ago, but he was fasting and he was explaining to them, I've been fasting and I've been in court. I need to have food, otherwise I'm going to pass out. Other prisoners basically created a fuss, and then he was able to get some food. And then they stuck him in a 30-degree heat cell. And if anyone remembers that February, it was hot. So it was hot in itself, it was hot outside, and he became extremely dehydrated. That went on for about a week, and only because I didn't hear from him for 5 days, I put in a welfare check because I was really concerned. From the welfare check, we then found out that basically he doesn't have access to a phone at the moment because the phone is broken which he had reported and told them that it was broken. He'd also reported about the heating being an issue, but they hadn't listened. At this point, he was near like breaking point. He was really upset on the phone, but couldn't talk long because they said it was only for like 2 minute call to your family. After that, I felt like if I didn't say something, he would have been kept in that cell for longer, because literally the day after, or I think, so that happened on like a Friday, Saturday, Monday, he was moved to another cell. All of a sudden, he's got access to a phone. And that particular story shows the importance of advocacy outside, advocacy from family, from loved ones, from the public. And that's why the hunger strike, I know we're going to go into it a little bit later, but the hunger strike only works with the work and advocacy outside. If we want our loved ones to succeed in getting their voices heard, the people out here have to be their voices. They have to be loud and proud, and they have to bring it to the streets. His change then to the new cell really helps him like readjust, but he struggled a little bit with prison politics, which I'm sure Francesca is very aware of. And then since then, he's like, not all guards are nice, but he's been able to get by. He's built relationships with the external workers that come to the prison. But what's coming out is that despite him developing, let's say, better relationships with some of the prison guards and officers, as he's gone on this hunger strike, he knew that animosity would build up. And so he's having more negative experiences inside prison. There was incidences of when he first was there, they would do lockdowns a lot, so he wouldn't get time outside. And when his MP intervened, the governor of the prison basically came and had a go at Cameron and said that he was making everything up and tried to intimidate him, which is insane because Cameron was like, actually, I've got it all listed here and I've been making note on the days. That was quite difficult for Cameron because he felt like they were trying to goad him into an argument or something for him to react so that they can then punish him. Mm. He was able to keep his cool, but Pentonville, because they are a failing prison, and because the Minister of Justice at the time had inquired about why are these prisoners not getting enough time out, suddenly got their back up. And so we're going to see this repeating again with the hunger strike as more publicity is shown on Pentonville, because they know they are a failing prison. The governor is going to try and suppress news about this as much as possible and is going to try and not engage with them as much as possible. And we saw this when Cameron was recently hospitalized. The governor made sure that we were not allowed any communication with Cameron. And that's not even to like speak to him on the phone. They decided not to give us any updates on his health, on what he's being treated for and how he is in the hospital. And also then denied this with his solicitor. So his solicitor, towards the end of his hospitalization, wasn't able to get any updates on him. So we can see that there's like a systematic attack to silence these prisoners and keep what they're going through as hidden as possible. But you wouldn't need to hide something if it wasn't unjust.
It was reported that Cameron was hospitalized because of the effects of the hunger strike on his body. How is his current health doing?
To be honest, currently his health is not doing amazing. He's really tired. He's finding evenings very difficult. He tends to fall asleep. Yesterday, he didn't call me in the evening. He's just finding it really hard to stay up. He's finding it really difficult to breathe. And then earlier today, he's noticed that his sugars are dropping again and his ketone levels are rising, which he feels like will indicate that he'll probably need to go back to hospital soon if those ketone levels don't stabilize. When he went into hospital, they basically found that he had acidic blood, which obviously is not good for the body. And they noticed that he had arrhythmias in his ECG. The arrhythmias, he's never had them before. So it's not like it's a genetic condition that he has. It's obviously developed from the hunger strike. And now he's getting difficulty breathing. So as you can see, his organs are really struggling to keep up with the demands on his body without food. with his time in the hospital, he said it was the most inhumane and degrading experience of his life. And actually, he wanted to be discharged because he could not handle being there anymore. When he got into the hospital, they made him wear hospital garments, despite the fact that other patients on the ward are in their normal clothes. They then took away his shoes, and he was not allowed to have any form of footwear. This meant that he would have to go to the toilet with bare feet, but the nurses on the ward were kind enough to provide him with two pairs of socks, so he was able to wear socks at least to the toilet. This ward was mainly filled with geriatric patients, like really elderly patients that have incontinence issues. So you can imagine the toilet wasn't the cleanest place. So then to be just going in socks is not nice. He talks about the experience of when he had to shower. The guard, because he has to stay cuffed to a guard at all times, the guard stands outside the door. He was holding Cameron's clothes and then just basically threw them on the floor. And the clothes got wet and there was brown stains on the floor. And so he asked the guard, would you wear that? What you've just dropped on the floor, you're expecting me to wear that now. Would you wear it? And he had nothing to say. And he's like, no, the water's clean. And Cameron felt, it's horrible. Like, you're now having to wear these clothes that you're picking up off the toilet floor. After that, on Thursday, they decided to put him, as to make him seem even more alien to the ward, they put him in an escape suit. And when he was discharged on Friday, they didn't give his shoes back. So he had to leave the hospital and return to the prison without shoes. He walked bare feet back to prison. And I'm just like, is that what's happening in the UK? That you can't even give him his shoes so he can walk back. And he said that the experience basically alienates you from the other people that are on the ward, because no one wants to talk to you. They just think you're a mad person or you're cuffed and you look like you're not someone that should be spoken to. Other things that happened was just like the doctors would only talk to the guards. He felt like sometimes they were ignoring him. He asked for his notes, summary of all of his medical notes from this admission, and the doctor turned around and asked the guard if that was okay, and the guard said no. And then Cameron was like, but it's my medical notes, it's about me, you don't need his permission to access my data, you need my permission. And they still refused to give him his medical notes, which was really interesting, because you can see, like, we talk about censorship, right? But who thought your medical notes would get censored? It's literally about your body.
It's really interesting, Shamina, because you talked earlier about the Palestinians who approached you in London to talk about the similarities with what Palestinians go through. And we know that the hunger strike has, for the whole of the Palestinian struggle, the hunger strike for Palestinian prisoners has been a tactic and a strategy of resistance for Palestinians. And, you know, we talk a lot in recent years about essentially the Israelification of the West in a lot of ways, of the in America, in the UK, the Israelification of a lot of institutions. And which, you know, it sounds from what you're saying, we're hearing, you know, the use of secret evidence, for example. They do that. The Israelis do that. We're seeing that being used in, again, the Palestine Action ban overturn. There is going to be secret evidence used there. The abuse and neglect of prisoners, as you've mentioned, and especially vindictive punishments that you've mentioned. A lot of it will have resonance for a lot of our listeners and viewers who are familiar with the details of how the Israelis treat Palestinian prisoners. Although, thankfully, the most extreme circumstances perhaps were not quite there yet, but nonetheless, it's very concerning to hear about all of this. Francesca, the other hunger striker who has been hospitalised recently is T. Hoxher, who's been on remand since November of last year. And earlier this month, she wrote a letter from inside prison, which we published at the Electronic Intifada. And in it, she talked about a previous hunger strike she'd embarked on and described how the conditions of the prisoners have deteriorated since the so-called terrorist ban on Palestine action. And she wrote, quote, "We have been removed from and refused jobs, called terrorists, harassed by guards, had social visits cancelled, had our mail blocked, and I had to go on a 28-day hunger strike to get my basic needs met. Our bail applications have been continuously denied, and my male co-defendants are being held in filthy, depressing conditions." She's now, again, once again, on hunger strike, joining some of the other prisoners at the moment on hunger strike. How many prisoners are on hunger strike at the moment? Is it six? Is that still the case?
Yeah, that's correct. There's six people on hunger strike, on full hunger strike. But there's also one person, our comrade Louis, who's on a partial hunger strike. So that's he's fasting once every 2 days. And that's because he's actually diabetic. So despite the fact that he's eating every other day, it's still incredibly dangerous for his health. But he's so determined, just like the other hunger strikers, to stand by their side in this moment to fight for justice, for their demands, that he continues to do it against the actual medical advice. I also would like to mention our comrade Uma, who from his prison cell just a few days ago was the first person, so very original, to do a defend our jury's action from inside a prison cell. So he made a statement that got put out afterwards, using the phrase that the defend our jury's people put on their placards, which is supporting a terrorist organization. And he just added at the end to the counter-terror police, "You know where I am, come and get me, I'm waiting for you." So that's the courage that we can see from all of the people right now in prison. And that's a rallying cry, a real example for people to follow. And that's why they're receiving so many solidarity actions around the world, that people are so moved and inspired by what they're doing.
So for context, Defend Our Juries is an organization which has been campaigning against, they've been going for a little while, and then they've actually been campaigning to defend juries, and it predates the issue of the ban of Palestine action, because there are wider issues of juries in Britain being allowed to acquit according to conscience. And actually, we've seen moves announced this past week by the so-called Justice Minister, David Lammy, again, in hock to the Israel lobby. He's definitely a very pro-Israel minister who has actually been financed by pro-Israel lobbyists. But he has actually announced that effectively the end of trial by jury, except for the most serious cases in the UK. So, you know, this is a real ongoing problem with the justice system in Britain. But Defend Our Juries has been campaigning against that, and they've been campaigning more specifically against the ban on Palestine action. And what you're referring to there is there's been civil disobedience against the ban on Palestine action over the last few months since the ban on Palestine action came into effect. And Defend Our Juries volunteers have been holding public gatherings where they deliberately hold signs that read, "I oppose genocide, I support Palestine action," and challenging authorities to arrest them. And I believe 2,000 of them have been arrested.
About 2,500. Right. And it's going up every day because more and more people are going out to get arrested, actually.
Yeah, so it's kind of a kind of mass civil disobedience. And there has been mixed results, actually, in some areas. Some police in some areas have had a more lenient attitude towards it. But there's certainly a lot of political pressure for them to be put away, it seems. And none of those cases have come to trial yet, but we'll see how that goes. But give us an update, if you can, if you know anything about T's current situation and condition and how she's being treated.
Yes, so as you mentioned, she was hospitalised. She's now been discharged, as far as I know. So I think a very similar situation health-wise as all the other hunger strikers. Now, after such a long period of time without food, they're all very weak, dizzy, they struggle to think clearly, make decisions, or, you know, their memories declined a lot as well. They've lost a lot of weight. One of the other people on hunger strike, Amu, has now lost 10 kilos. That was the last update that I had. So it's reaching a critical point now in everybody's health who's on the hunger strike. So for that same reason, a critical point in this campaign, and the urgency is really there to do everything we can to support these demands, to support the hunger strikers, and to get the demands that they're asking for. The key thing right now is visibility. So like I said, we've had this mainstream media blackout. We will keep pushing that in any way we can, because that is sadly the way that most people find out what's going on in the world. So we have to make our own visibility. We're asking everybody in whatever way they can to make it known to the world what is going on. These people are hunger striking for justice, for their own justice and for the Palestinian people. And alongside that visibility, the public pressure grows on the British state to fulfill their demands. So this is what we're asking for. Just get out there and tell everybody about the hunger strikers and take a look at our website for more specific ways to help.
That's prisonersforpalestine.org. Thank you very much. Shamina, do you have any final thoughts or message?
Right now, the lives of our loved ones, especially the hunger strikers, is in the hands of the government. And the government can either choose to repeat 1981, or they can choose to be different and finally rise up and actually take accountability for their actions and support in this genocide, and finally put their British citizens first rather than the Israeli lobby.
Thank you. Well, by referring to 1981 there, of course, you're referring to the hunger strikers in the north of Ireland, and most famously led by the Irish Republican prisoner Bobby Sands, who actually died under a hunger strike during the government of Margaret Thatcher in the Mays prison in the north of Ireland. So we thank both of you today for joining us and for sharing your experience with us and for keeping us up to date with all of this. Thank you both today.
That was Shahmina Alam, the sister of Kamran Ahmed, one of the hunger strikers, and Francesca Nadine, a spokesperson for the new group Prisoners for Palestine. The interview was recorded on December 2nd. For the latest updates on the hunger strike, go to prisonersforpalestine.org. Thank you for tuning into Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and our live stream, check out electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. The Electronic Intifada is a program service of the Middle East Cultural and Charitable Society, Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, online at cjsf.ca. Broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Home of Mafog the Dog.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Each week at a warehouse in Brooklyn, volunteers sort through thousands of pounds of fabric, from colorful cotton scraps to unused bolts of linen and silk.
What a lot of people don't realize is that along the course of the production of garment making, there is a lot of waste that happens along the way.
Camille Tagle is co-founder of Fab Scrap. The nonprofit partners with clothing brands to reuse and recycle textile waste, including fabric samples, prototype designs, and scraps left over after cutting and sewing. Some of the material is sold online or in person at the organization's store.
Maybe, you know, somebody wants to make a top or a dress out of one of our fabrics. People also use it for arts and crafts.
Other material gets shredded into a product that's used for insulation, carpet padding, and more. Tagle says reusing and recycling textile waste helps keep material out of landfills where it emits climate-warming methane as it decomposes. And it reduces the amount of new material that needs to be produced in the first place, which cuts down on carbon pollution at all stages of the supply chain. So FabScrap is helping reduce the climate impact of fashion, one scrap at a time.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.